The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Cass Sheeran with Disability Rights North Carolina, coming to you with another installment of Legal Matters. Disability Rights NC is an independent 501c3 nonprofit organization and a member of the National Disability Rights Network. As I mentioned, I'm Cass Sheeran, and I've been on DRNC's communications team for a couple of years now. I've been with the agency for 15 years in various positions and absolutely love what this committed, passionate team of people accomplish on behalf of people with disabilities, always with the needs and desires of disabled people centering our work. We do a wide variety of work on behalf of the nearly 3 million disabled people throughout North Carolina. You can learn a lot about the work we do on our website, disabilityrightsnc.org. Right now, a big feature on our website is registration for our annual conference, this year called Stronger Together in North Carolina. This 7th annual Disability Advocacy Conference is a one-day event on Tuesday, May the 2nd, from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. It'll be held at the McKimmon Center here in Raleigh near North Carolina State University. We'll be bringing together people with disabilities, family members, policymakers, advocates, and other professionals in the field to share, learn, motivate, and create opportunities for change. We hope you'll join us, and please spread the word. And by the way, when you visit our website, please let us know if you experience any disability accessibility issues. We've worked really hard to address that, and we want to know. This is a real priority for us, and if you experience any barriers, we want to know about them. We're constantly working to improve. Now for today's show. North Carolina's 109 jails confine thousands of people with disabilities each year. The people of North Carolina rely on our elected sheriffs to provide safe and humane conditions in the jails. North Carolina laws establish minimum standards, called the jail rules, that jails must operate by. But do they follow these rules? And what consequences do jails face when they don't? DRNC conducted an investigation of North Carolina jails' compliance with these jail rules and the state's oversight and enforcement of the rules. We found that far too many jails don't follow the rules and that oversight system that we rely on is under-resourced and ineffective. Weak enforcement of the jail rules by an extremely short-staffed state investigation team at the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, allows North Carolina's jails to remain open despite dangerous and sometimes deadly conditions. DHSR's limited tools and personnel often leave them unable to hold jails to minimum safety standards, leading to chronic overcrowding, supervision failures, and a lax fire safety. Many people have died in these unsafe conditions, even after facilities fail inspection after inspection. In addition to these failures, our investigation found several instances of jails falsifying records in attempts to pass inspection, for which there were no consequences. With me today to talk about this investigation are two of Disability Rights North Carolina's lawyers. Luke Woolard is on our criminal justice team and focuses primarily on conditions in North Carolina's jails. Corey Dunn is our director of public policy. Luke's extensive findings are detailed in a report on our website called A Slap on the Wrist and a Rubber Stamp, North Carolina Lets Sheriffs Break All the Rules. And if you want to go to the website to see that report, go to the search engine and type in jails safety, and it will be the first thing that pops up. I'm so glad you guys are here today to talk about this really important work. First of all, Luke, can you tell us something about the findings in your investigation?
Absolutely. So speaking broadly, we found that a large number of these jails, about 60% of the years we looked at, which is 2017 through 2019, were failing their inspections. Each jail is inspected twice yearly, and we found that a majority of the jails were failing these inspections for anything from construction issues, broken lighting, to much more serious things like overcrowding, failure to provide supervision rounds, and various other issues that we not only saw them failing regularly, but we saw them failing repeatedly over time. Just a basic failure to fix things that were being repeatedly cited in these failed inspections.
And why is this an important issue for people with disabilities, Luke?
Because people with disabilities are overrepresented in our jail population. And by that I mean, on any given day, there's about 15,000 to 20,000 people in custody in North Carolina jails. I'll mention a majority of those have yet to be tried or convicted of anything. And among those folks, many have a disability of some kind, whether we're talking about physical disabilities, whether we're talking about folks who are blind, who have low vision, or folks who have mental health issues or substance use issues. As I'm sure a lot of people know, you know, disability is very broad, and we unfortunately see more people with disabilities in our jails as compared to in the state population generally. Mm-hmm. So that's why we thought it's an important issue to us, and we didn't see that many people, you know, looking in on what was happening in jails, and we thought we needed to investigate, and this report is the result of some of that investigation.
Thank you. And Corey, from a public policy perspective, why are these issues important?
Well, like Luke said, people with disabilities are present at about twice the rate in our jails as they are in our general population. That means that if we really want to advance and protect the rights of people with disabilities, we have to look at what's going on in our jails. And that means being concerned about safety, being concerned about the health and well-being of people who are in custody, because the vast majority of people who are in our state's jails are going to come out. They're going to come back into our communities. And we don't want a system that returns people to their families and communities more broken than they went in. And that is unfortunately what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. And if it's unsafe for the people who are being incarcerated, it stands to reason that it might be unsafe for the people who work there as well?
That's absolutely right. And we know that in many communities, jails are a major employment center. And so if the largest employer or a major employer is an unsafe place to work, mm-hmm. what does that mean for the health and well-being of our communities?
Right. You bring up an important point. Because one of the things, Luke, I remember you saying is that geography matters in this. And, mm-hmm. like, there are some areas in the state where jails are less safe than other areas of the state. Can you talk a little bit about that?
There certainly are. So North Carolina, we've got 100 counties, a little over 100 jails, and each county jail is run by the county sheriff. Pretty exclusively, the sheriff's budget is controlled by the county commissioners in that county, but the sheriff's really making most of the calls. And the resources that go into the jail are, again, based on what resources are available in the county. So you understandably have many counties with lower populations or lower resources that have, smaller jails, but also fewer resources to run those jails. That translates into treatment of folks who wind up in these jails, because if you are in a bigger or richer county, your Mecklenburg's, your Wake County, they are going to have usually more and better resources to care for folks who come into the jail, to provide accommodations regarding disability, or provide the medical care either in the facility or out, than other jails that really don't have those. And we certainly saw a difference in several counties. In terms of overcrowding, in terms of repeatedly failing inspections, some counties did very well, and we did try and list those in the report, the folks who were passing inspections or fixing issues pretty quickly. And there were several counties, again, the report, who we saw very, very dangerous conditions, repeated citations for the same dangerous condition over months and years, meaning that we really do have sort of a separate system in each county, and where you are arrested and where somebody might end up in jail is going to very much determine the treatment that they get, or really in terms of medical treatment, the treatment that's even possible in the jail.
So you mentioned that there are a few, 14, 15 or so jails that either didn't fail any inspections during the period that you looked at, mm-hmm. or if they did fail one or two, they very quickly brought them into compliance. So that mm-hmm. suggests that the rules are there that can be easily followed, and that errors can be easily remedied. And so what's happening in these jails where it's that's not happening, and they're happening over and over and over, just citation after citation, because I remember you saying that there were some counties where for years they continued to be cited for the same issues with no repair.
Mm-hmm. I think it really does come down to the regulatory system that we have in the state. You mentioned that the inspectors, we would really like there to be more of them, but the inspectors are going out and doing their jobs in these facilities. Otherwise, we wouldn't know about these failed inspections.
Mm.
What really concerned us was that we kept seeing, you're right, the same failure over and over again. And to us, the way we looked at it is that speaks to a failure of DHSR to regulate the jails, to really have any penalties in place that are going to be effective. Because that affects the way, the sheriff and the county commissioners react to these citations. If the county commissioners or the sheriff see the failure again and again, but there are no repercussions for that, they're less likely to prioritize that, knowing that often fixing these problems means taking some county money that would have gone somewhere else and meeting minimum jail safety standards. And we really feel that right now DHSR doesn't have great options for enforcement of jail standards. If a jail fails an inspection and they fail again and they fail again, and even if, DHSR is really trying to work with them to solve the problem, often there are monetary barriers or just physical barriers with overcrowding in that facility that, can't be solved in the short term, or maybe just these repeat failures. And the only thing DHSR can really do in that scenario where it's an unsafe jail, and it has been for a while, is threatened to shut down the facility. And that is a nuclear option. I mean, that's the big red button on the desk, mm-hmm. right? That is incredibly impractical. For some of these larger jails, it would mean that, hundreds, maybe, upwards of 1,000 folks would need to be moved out to other counties. That stresses the other counties. There's a lot of red tape to go through before you can close a jail. It's not a very quick and effective regulatory method. So what we've really been asking for is letting DHSR regulate jails, in a way similar to the way they regulate adult care homes or long-term care facilities, which is you have a range of options, right? It's not just do I press the big red button or do I not. There are fines that can be implemented in those facilities. There are things that need to be fixed before an inspector leaves if it's a serious enough violation. And we really feel like the jail regulatory system is missing that sort of aspect, those, medium and, as we'd like to say, less severe but more immediate punishments for these repeat mm-hmm. violations.
So it sounds to me, Corey, that he's describing things that DHSR could not just decide on itself to implement, right?
Right. DHSR doesn't have all the tools it needs to be an effective oversight agency for this kind of facility. So it's really important to know that there's a team of, correct me if I'm wrong, Luke, three?
Yes, I believe it's still three.
Three inspectors. Who are responsible for inspecting all 109 jails in our state. And that, plainly that's not enough. But more importantly, we've also, put more responsibility recently on DHSR in the form of an appeals process that's going to be potentially very labor intensive mm-hmm. for them. And so what we want is for inspectors to be able to go into a facility, do what they're trained to do to make people safer. And when I say make people safer, I mean people in custody, people who work there, people in the community. We're talking about violations as basic as refusing to conduct fire safety drills or to properly document those drills, things that any large building is expected to do. And certainly when folks are locked into limited mobility and have and especially when there are a substantial number of people who have disabilities in those spaces, we want to make sure that on just a really basic level, folks are physically safe. Mm-hmm. And that's not too much to ask. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they need more tools. They need more people.
Right.
And that's going to cost some money. That doesn't happen for free. And we can't spare them from some other part of mm-hmm. that agency's functions. They need additional staffing.
So this report that you did, Luke, is one of a continuation of work that you and the criminal justice team have done over the last few years. The past reports have looked at the number of deaths that are occurring in our state's jails and how they have increased year upon year upon year. Mm-hmm. And in preparing for this episode, you sent an email that said you just got new numbers that 20 more people than the previous year mm-hmm. had died in our jails. Can you tell us a little bit about why people are dying in our jails?
Absolutely. So we have, I believe, reports on the website up through 2020. We've recently gotten the 2021 and 2022 jail death numbers. Those numbers continue to go up. I mean, in 2020, when we published, I believe, 50-some-odd that we cite in that report, was the highest we'd seen since we started tracking in 2016. 2021, there looked to be around 70. 2022, we just got a list, and it appears to be around 90 folks. So it is climbing at a high rate, at a rate that is higher than is seen in a lot of other states in the country. And really the issues that we see coming up more and more are suicides are always a fairly large percentage of those number of those deaths. We see many that are due to medical conditions. In several cases, analyzing these deaths, we would call those avoidable deaths if proper medical treatment had been given when it was requested or when it became really clear to somebody, even a layperson, a CO who was walking around, the person should have gotten medical treatment. They may have survived. We see a good number of overdose deaths from folks with just untreated SUD, and we see a lot of withdrawal deaths. So a lot of drug-related deaths that are the result of anything from failure to screen and recognize that the person is in danger, failure to provide treatment options when the person is in the facility, and similar issues with suicides, failure to properly screen for risk, failure to supervise the folks properly when they're in, and failure to have adequate programs, suicide prevention programs, to deal with that. So those are just some of the types of deaths that we see in these facilities.
Luke, you mentioned SUD. Could you tell us what that is?
Excuse me. That is substance use disorder. So it is essentially somebody who is struggling with addiction. And you're very right, Cass, that these facilities, and I think a lot of the sheriffs would agree with us, one of the points we agree on is they've become de facto mental health care facilities.
Yeah.
Since we really, years ago defunded a lot of the community health spaces. And they've also, with the opioid epidemic and lack of local community resources around that, have become sort of de facto treatment centers where somebody probably should be in a hospital or at least a place that's able to properly, observe the withdrawal symptoms and provide proper medication. They're not. We've had several cases where somebody wasn't screened when they were brought in. Often they will report drug use, but then they're put into a single cell and allowed to just decompensate until, their health is seriously damaged, or in some cases they die. It's a similar thing with, suicide and mental health. So in a lot of these communities, the only people that folks can call when a loved one or a neighbor, they see that person, suffering in mental health or substance use crisis, is the police. And then the folks, they end up in these facilities due to lack of community health care and lack of programs to get them anywhere else. And then the jails were not initially designed and are certainly not living up to current safety standards to keep those people mm-hmm. safe in many of these facilities.
And they could be providing supports. Not that every jail has the resources to right now, but there are things that jails are doing in other places that are very effective. Medication-assisted treatment is one of those to help people detox and prevent serious withdrawal symptoms and also prevent future drug use through an opioid antagonist mm-hmm. program. Those are really successful programs where they've been implemented. We know that not every jail is ready to do that tomorrow, but we do think that it's an important part of ending preventable deaths in jails.
And that's something that we're not prepared to talk about yet today, but we did recently get a grant that we're going to be looking into, seeing how that might work in North Carolina and offer up some ideas and some policy positions on that. Luke, you mentioned that there are people who are blind and have low vision in the jails. Can you tell us a little bit about accommodations for people who are blind and have low vision, or just people with disabilities in general in the jails with regard to communication, with regard to just access? And fire safety as well. That's a giant question.
Well, we can focus on, the communications first. We certainly see some jails that are set up all right for communications for folks with hearing issues or vision issues, and we see some that certainly are not. You know, a lot of facilities for folks with hearing issues are still using ancient TTY phones that are, at this point, I would argue, more than obsolete. For folks with vision issues, you know, we see jails that are not set up to provide, you know, any materials in, you know, large fonts. And we're especially sort of tracking a trend right now in the prisons, and we've seen in some of the jails, which is switching over to the use of tablets for communication, for phone calls, for, you know, getting messages out, and also programming, like the classes that you would take or would be provided, or, you know, even sort of the treatment resources that are available for you, things like making sick calls, stuff like that. And we are looking into making sure that whenever a prison or jail implements that tablet system, if that's going to be the only way that someone can make a call or can request sick call or file a grievance, that those are, you know, 100% accessible for everybody. Because, again, you know, we don't want there to be a situation where, you know, a prisoner or jail might be trying to improve the services through the use of these tablets, but are in fact, you know, removing access for an entire swath of their population because they didn't consider the needs of folks with disabilities. And on the safety issue, a lot of the violations that we saw were things like fire safety, fire equipment not being properly updated, certainly in more extreme cases, you know, administrators telling employees to say a fire drill had been conducted when none had, which is especially troubling in a jail setting because, as you might imagine, it's a lot harder to get folks out of cells, out of cell blocks, and everything safely in a fire drill situation than it is even to evacuate a large building. So the fact that this wasn't being done, we feel, really puts people with disabilities at risk, you know, specifically folks who would have mobility issues, or issues with vision, or even issues, you know, with hearing, who can't hear orders or try and follow, you know, so they really need to be living up to all the minimum fire standards within the jails, and we really didn't see that. And, you know, everything we feel puts folks with disabilities at a little more risk. That's the same for supervision. Somebody not making the rounds who might not know that somebody who has mobility issues is in distress, and if they're in their cells, you wouldn't know if the folks aren't doing supervision rounds. And things like overcrowding that just stress the entire system. You know, a facility that is at 130% of the capacity it was even designed to hold, much less making sure everyone has the right staff, we have facilities that were not designed to hold the number of people that they're holding, and that overcrowding stresses the whole system. It stresses medical resources, staff resources, pretty much everything, to the point that we feel puts everyone in the facility in danger, but especially folks with disabilities.
So you mentioned something a few minutes ago I wanted to follow up on, and Corey, I think it might have been you, but I'm not sure which one of y'all talked about it, that there's a new law that allows for appeals that's going to stress the investigators, inspectors, their time even more. Can you talk a little bit about that?
For a long time, there's been a pretty straightforward process of, here's your violation, please fix it. Okay, you fixed it or you didn't. There is going to be an opportunity for sheriffs to appeal those findings, and that's going to slow down the process pretty dramatically. It's going to bring in a third party who is neither the regulatory agency nor the sheriff's department, that will have the ability to decide if a finding of violation is correct. And that means that those three people who are responsible for overseeing the safety of all 109 jails are going to have to spend time sitting in an administrative hearing rather than going out to another jail. And that's going to even further limit our state's capacity to ensure safety.
So that we have to be sort of in a, like a courtroom, so to speak, an administrative courtroom.
When we say an administrative hearing, we mean it feels like court. It isn't technically court, but it's definitely handing the decision over to a third party who hasn't been involved so far. We don't really know what it's going to look like because we haven't done it yet, but we do know that it's going to stress an already under-resourced oversight system.
And there was one other law that I think one of you mentioned that recently passed, or maybe last year passed, that put restrictions on overcrowding and limits, because you were noting how important overcrowding is to a jail's overall operations. What's the status of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So those were updates to the jail rules that actually passed they had passed through DHHS's rulemaking system. They passed the legislature in 2020. They became effective, I believe, in September of 2020. We and other advocacy agencies really lobbied hard and won a further restriction on overcrowding, which basically says once you hit the total design capacity, once you have so many people in the building that literally it's not designed to be safe after that, you have to start moving folks out. Whether that's moving them to other counties, moving them through the statewide misdemeanor confinement program, there's a number of avenues you can use to reduce the jail population, but it just says once you hit this limit, you must start to reduce your population, at least back beyond the 100% level, ideally below the 80% level, where everyone, corrections and advocates, both agree that that's really where you're actually safe. We've not seen that just outright, that it is great that that update to the jail rules happened. We haven't seen it in effect. We still have about the same number of jails that are severely overcrowded month after month, day after day, in these inspections, going all the way up to the end of 2022. So that is, again, something that we really feel DHSR needs new regulatory tools to enforce. Because, like I said, overcrowding makes every other aspect of the jail dangerous for staff and for the folks who are incarcerated there.
And there is capacity statewide to meet the need that is present. So it's not like we're asking to just wholesale open the doors and let people out. We're saying there are ways to manage your capacity that people are not using in our counties right now, and that we need them to keep people safe.
Well, I just really want to thank y'all both for coming here and talking about these issues, because I think that they're not only are they important, but they're really hidden from our
quite
communities.
Quite literally.
Yes, quite literally. And so thank you very much, Luke, for your work, and Corey, for your work as well in highlighting these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters, but be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Cass Sheeran with Disability Rights North Carolina, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call at 919-832-5138.